Ben Fagan here with another episode of Career Cash, the podcast. And on this episode, I sit down with Penn State law student Seth Hojanacki. On the episode, Seth and I talk about his biggest takeaways from his time in law school so far, the importance of being genuine, and how small shifts in your perspective can change the whole game. It's an awesome conversation. Let's get to it. Today, we have Mr. Seth Hojanacki. Seth, how are you doing today? Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ben. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is episode 47 of the Career Cash, the podcast overall series. And you know what they say about number 47, right?
Best number in the world, right?
See, that was the first question. It was a hard-hitting question for you. They're only going to get easier from here. So, how we kind of like to start, every show is gathering a bit of context about, what you do on a day-to-day basis. And this brings context for the people listening, watching, wherever they may be. So kind of catch us up, because I know that you've transitioned over the past year or so into another phase of your professional journey. And it's a really cool one, and one that I, wanted to kind of dive into today. So catch us up on where you're at, what you're doing, the latest and greatest, and then we'll kind of dive into how you got there.
Well, I appreciate, the nice words, the sentiment at the beginning. So I'm presently a law clerk at an attorney's office called Ward, Hawker & Thornton in Lexington, Kentucky. They are a civil litigation law firm specializing in insurance defense, but they do take a wide variety of clientele and cases. So I'm fortunate to not just work on insurance matters, but also a wide range of different types of cases. So I've been able to work on a lot of different things this summer. So I'm really happy for the opportunity.
Nice. So, and talking about going to law school. So this is what you're doing in the summer. Talk about when the fall rolls around, where you're at, and then let's talk. I wanna because you, before we kind of jumped into the show, you talked about how you ended up where you are, and it was kind of almost on a whim. So can you dive into how you got into law school and what that whole journey was like, and why?
Sure.
I guess even before that, even like why law school?
So I think that's a big question. I know a lot of, if anyone's interested in going to law school, that's a number one essay question, that, why do you want to be a lawyer? And everyone and their brother is going to say, I want to help people, or I want to represent, injured people, or I want to represent corporations. For me, my journey into law school, and I would say the law overall, started with really compliance and trying to just cross my T's and dot my I's and make sure everything was in alignment. And I knew with legal and regulatory standards, like that, those were kind of the thresholds you have to meet for certain jobs or certain job responsibilities. And so while president of SAC, I got to work hand in hand with Courtney. I can't think of her last name at the moment, but Courtney was our NCAA compliance director for quite some time at Lynn. And Courtney Ullery, she now is, I think, out of San Francisco University or University of San Francisco. Either way, she was a wonderful resource that really kind of helped me facilitate my, I didn't want to do business solely. I didn't want to do salesman. I was more interested in the compliance side, and I was starting to look into law school, and we had a long conversation where she kind of said, if this is something that you're really considering, you should absolutely go do. And kind of on a whim decided, okay, I'll send applications to Penn State, because she was an alum. And I was fortunate enough to get accepted, and the kind of rest was history. And I'm fortunate enough to be going to Penn State Law right now.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so working through that process of saying like, hey, this is something that I want to do. What were some of the things that were important to you? When did you look at only Penn State just because of that connection? Or were you looking otherwhere in other places too? What was important to you when you were looking for a school that you wanted to go to?
So I knew when I was, because I was finishing my MBA at Lynn, and I knew I was considering law school and that I wanted to go somewhere out of Florida. I love the state of Florida. I think it's a great state, but the law school is at least near Lynn. I believe Nova has a law school, and I just knew that I kind of wanted to spread my wings. I even applied to University of Kentucky, and I applied also University of Kentucky, Michigan State, Penn State, and a couple other schools. The other schools I was not accepted into, but I knew I wanted to get out of the state of Florida, and Penn State just ended up being kind of the perfect fit between a Northeast school, similar kind of vibes as you would get at Lynn with so many people from the Northeast, but also a program more geared towards corporate law and transactional, which is kind of funny because I now work in litigation, which is not transactional, but it's enabled me to have a more, I don't want to say more professional environment, but more corporate oriented, a lot of business majors, a lot more business savvy people. Whereas it's common for Bachelor of Arts in political science, English, those studies to be going towards law school.
Mm-hmm. No, that's interesting. And shout out to Nova Law. That's the alma mater of my mom and my uncle. So go Sharks there.
Sharks, a quality law program. Right, nothing against them. I was very happy to get a scholarship offer to Penn State. So it was tough to say.
That's awesome. And it really is important to find a place that works for you, that you're going to enjoy. Cause obviously it's not only an investment, you know, of the school side of things, but you're living there. It's a place that you want to, you know, so it's important to be in an environment that makes sense and be in a program that makes sense. So that's, you know, really good that it sounds like you found that. And so have you completed your first year?
Yes. So I finished my 1L year. So the terminology they use in law school is 1L, 2L, and 3L. I finished my 1L year, first year. The phrase that I think every attorney says is that, you know, they scare you 1L year, they work you to death 2L year, and then something about like they don't care 3L year because they only care about the bar exam. Mm-hmm. So basically it's, you know, I've ran the hardest part of the race, but the race isn't over. Right. It's just the hardest, I guess, lap is done.
Yeah. And so can you talk about, this is something that we were also kind of discussing before we really jumped into the show here, was the transition between undergrad and even your master's at Lynn, and then what law school kind of entails. And you talked a lot about it not necessarily like being good, bad, and different. Good or bad, but it's just different, you know? And so can you kind of dive into those differences and what were some of the things that you noticed early on that you're learning, still adjusting to maybe between undergrad, your master's at Lynn, and then law school at Penn State?
I would definitely think a big first step is the luxury of Lynn being a smaller school, smaller class sizes. You're a lot more personable with your professors. Whereas at Penn State Law, I think the 1L class was roughly 140, maybe about 140 kids. My section, I think, was around 53, with majority being 1Ls. There were a few LLMs, which is master program. Mm-hmm. But those are normally the international students that also are taking the 1L curriculum. But I would say roughly probably in the 46 range for 1L students. And one of the things I think I really learned was think before you speak, which, I mean, kind of sounds remedial, but at the same time, cold calls are very big in law school. That's, I think, the Socratic method, and having just random call outs that you'll just be standing there and the professor will be like, Seth, tell us about this case. And you are fully expected to brief the entire case. And my first instance was in torts with Professor Romero. He is now the dean, or the interim dean, of the school. But he was known for being a little difficult in his cold calls. Mm-hmm. And my first cold call with him was 20 some minutes long.
Okay.
And it's like an hour, 40 minute class. So, you know, it's a long class, but not, it was a long cold call. And it did not feel like 20 minutes because you're nerves, you're tense, you're just, he's asking a question and you're just spitting an answer, just hoping that you get the right thing. Uh-huh. And it's just a lot of back and forth. And I realized just the amount of prep work that goes in, not only just for cold calls, but every day in class, because you never know when you're going to get called. Mm-hmm. So you got to be able to read 50 pages a night, summarize it, and be able to regurgitate it the next day and explain the thought process behind it, you know, the legal theories, parts of the case. And there's just a learning curve that I was unaware of, because studying business and getting an MBA, very question, answer. There's not the nuances of, well, explain your answer in further detail, kind of like the chicken scratch analogy we talked about before the show, that they really do want to see that chicken scratch in full light, but they also want it polished to a degree. If that make, I mean, it may not make sense, but they, there's just a, it's a different, the way I've described it is a different way of thinking. Business oriented and law oriented, although they seem very similar, there are very little differences that make a world of difference.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that was always interesting about what my mom said from, you know, her practicing law. She's a public defender, retired within the past couple of years. And, you know, she reflecting on her experience in law school too, that was one of the things. And even throughout her professional career was kind of the ability to, what you're saying is like, take these ideas, and it's so much less black and white, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. They're like, okay, well, does it really? And what about in this instance, you know, and stuff like that. And so that's just such an interesting thing. And I think, what if we can go back in time to that first cold call and really, really walk me through that mental, like what was going through your head when, you know, he says, Seth, what do you got for us? Talk to me about like what that was like for you.
So I remember the day pretty clear. I would say, I try not to say that I have bad days. I try to have a very positive mindset, but I would say I was not having the best morning, and torts was our afternoon class. So I remember we have a Panera. It's kind of like a cafeteria, but it's technically a Panera that's connected to the law school, very small room. But I remember sitting in the Panera before class, and I made a joke to one of my friends. It was either Sam or Joe, saying, this is my day. I'm going to get cold called. And they were kind of like, what makes you say that? I'm like, I don't know. I got this gut feeling. Like, I'm not
feel it in the air.
And I'm admitting I'm ill prepared. Like, I know the case. I know it's a tort. I know we're in the negligence. I don't really know the nuances. Like, I kind of know it, but like, I had one other question, not a full cold call, but like professor asks me just a question and I fudged it in civil procedure. So I'm sitting there like, oh yeah, I'm going to get cold called since I'm unlucky. This is just not my day. Sure enough, first cold call of the day goes to me, and I just had started a new practice, and I don't know if I would recommend this to anyone going into law school, but it was recommended to me, which is when you brief your cases, some people brief them on a, you know, loose leaf piece of paper on the side, other people do it in the book. And this was like the first case I decided to brief in the book. So he's asking me questions and I'm probably just staring at the book like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. But so he asked, I don't exactly remember the first question, but I didn't know the answer. Like, I just instantly was like, oh God, I don't know the answer. So then I instantly just try to play it off. And I go, would you like me to start with the procedural history or the substantive facts? And he goes, actually, I don't want any of that. And we spoke the whole time about the theory of the case. And I remember it was something about, I believe, Minnesota and what, you know, what is basically the whole idea was that every state has different standards for what they believe is like reasonable care, like a standard of care. But the whole 20-minute conversation actually became about the idea of negligence as it's applied in the case rather than any of this information that I had briefed. So I didn't even use this brief. I'm just kind of riffing with the professor, but the entire time I'm sweating bullets. You know, I'm pretty sure I'm probably have like my hand, like my thumbs, like squeezing, just like, oh my God, just like, oh God, oh God, oh God, can this stop? And I just distinctly remember there was a second where like I thought it was over. And he does. And it was early in the semester, so it ended up becoming like a thing that he did all year. And I was unaware at the time, but it seemed like it was done. Because like, I think he even asked somebody a question. And then instantly pivots back to me. He's like, so what do you think about that, Seth? How do we take it? Like, what do we do about that? And I'm like, oh, well, it's not over. Like, I sigh of relief, boom, right back into it.
Right.
So it was a very positive experience because in my head, I thought I blundered it. I thought it was awful. Probably similar to how I, you know, feel now where I'm just rambling, but I, you know, at least somebody came up to me after and was like, hey, good job. And I was like, that was good. I felt like I was an idiot. Like, so there's a learning curve and it's a trial by fire. You're going to get thrown in. Socratic method is designed to do that. They're putting you on the spot. Spotlight's on you. They just want to see how you're going to do.
And so did you get like a standing ovation?
So I can't say I did not get that. I did get cold called about a month later, which I think was in my head, a quick turnaround, but it's probably normal for like law school. But I just distinctly remember almost a similar procedure where I tried to pull the kind of the same stunt, like, oh, do you want me to start with procedural history or substantive facts? And I think this time he was like, oh, start with the facts. I'm like, oh, okay.
Let's
And then
go.
just, you know, like read my brief. And I was like, okay, well, plaintiff did this, defendant did that, blah, blah, blah. And so I just, that class was a lot. It was the professor teaching it, who's now the interim dean, was told to, he was going to take this class about 2 weeks before the year started, because the professor who normally teaches the class unfortunately had passed away right before the school year. And so, you know, this professor, who I think was a law, he's been a law professor for over 20, 25 years, a brilliant man, Victor Romero, have nothing but amazing things to say about him. But he took it like a champ. He took this class with 2 weeks of prep and taught us very valuable information. And I working in civil litigation, majority of insurance defense is tort cases, a lot of times negligence. And the stuff I learned in his class has been applicable in practice. And it's just, I'm very grateful for the professors at Penn State.
No, that's awesome. And I think that's such a, you know, really important thing. And it sucks in the moment always to, you know, go through the trial by fire thing, you know, but I think trying to go through it with that mentality of saying, hey, you know, this is just an experience. It's a learning curve, you know, will help you ultimately in the end. And so how has that experience, how has it kind of shown up in, you know, different stages, you know, throughout your studies so far, in terms of being able to kind of think on your feet or just be more comfortable with, you know, that kind of environment?
So I think it's a great question, because for this law firm and this clerkship, one of the first things that we worked on were goals. What did we want, like, for the summer? And my number one goal was to be more comfortable discussing and handling legal matters. Being a first generation law student, no one in my family is an attorney. So it's been a big learning curve, but I also realize it's partially on me, because it's up to me to be confident to speak up when I know the right answer. So, you know, I had an associate ask me how something sounded, and I answered it truthfully. And, you know, it sounded very well, and, you know, very good. The guy was just checking with me, but then I was reflecting on it. Like, why did I hesitate? Like, I minored in English. I know how to write English. Like, I can write sentences. Right. It's not, I try not to psych myself out of it. So that's why my goal is to be more comfortable. And a big thing that I've really have seen in this is, there's a Harvard Business Review study called Get Excited, Reappraising Pre-Performance Anxiety as Excitement. And I think this changed the game for me personally, because basically it's an empirical study that found, if you tell yourself you're excited, you will perform better. Even if you're as nervous as can be, your legs are shaking, simply verbally telling yourself, and like the affirmation of, I am excited about this, you're going to have a lot more positive mindset going in, and therefore you have better success. And the irony is, I found this article, I think, October, November of law school. So, you know, I was preaching about this every day going to class. I'm excited for class. I'm excited for exams. I can sit here and tell you these people had success. They had improvements in their scores. I don't know if my scores reflect any improvement based on positivity, but it has helped me rationalize the grades I have and to realize, A, not the end of the world. Not every class, there's 3 A's. Not everyone's going to get an A. And everyone being an overachiever, type A personality, is used to being the person in the class to get the A. So now only 3 people can get an A. And it was not me. And that's okay. That's not the end of the world, because they're, once you're a lawyer, you have a lifetime to practice the law. Most of the time, they don't care if you had an A or a B plus in a certain subject once you're practicing, because they just want to make sure you're a competent attorney. So I think a big thing with the perspective of get excited is also get excited, not of mediocrity, but get excited that you accomplished something. So get excited that, okay, I'm going to take this exam. My entire grade relies on this one exam. If I mess it up, my whole grade's done. Sure enough, you're going to mess something up, but it's not the end of the world, because you got to be able to pivot. You got to be able to handle, you know, failure and mismanagement, and be able to kind of reapply yourself to get back on solid footing. And I think that's a valuable experience that I've learned while at law school.
No, that's all. And what was not getting the A always okay, or was it until you got this study that it wasn't?
I would say growing up, I was never an all A student. Even at Lynn, I didn't have a 4.0. I had my first 4.0 semester at Lynn, but I never had so I was never an all A student while my entire life. But the idea of, because there's no homework assignments, every day you go to class with the exact same people talking about the same 60 pages of reading, and you're all graded at the end of the year. And there are people, and it pains me to say this, but there are people who are brilliant without having to try. It just clicks. They know, it just works out. And I realized, especially during the spring finals, why am I stressing myself out? Why am I having anxiety about something that could be inevitable? Like, if I was so worried about doing bad, not getting the A, well, guess what? I manifested not getting the A. And then I had to reevaluate, saying, well, I've stressed myself out so much that that probably was counterintuitive to the goal of getting the A. So it kind of helped me perspective shift of, okay, I don't care about an A. I care about doing as best as I can. And even if my grades are not the best in the class, I'm still grateful that I got to go to Penn State and go through these classes, because it's a once in a lifetime experience. There's no other time that you'll be able to go to Penn State Law in 2022 to 2023 learning from those guys. It's just, and I try to take that into everything, that everything's a once in a lifetime experience, because it's the first time you're living. Even if it's the routine, mundane, day-to-day stuff, it's still the first, that's the only day. Today is the only July 12th, 2023 there is. So even if you do everything the exact same that you've been doing every other day of the year, it's still a different day. So I try to keep that once in a lifetime thing kind of on my shoulder.
No, I love that. I mean, you're talking my language here. You're getting me going, you're getting me fired up. And excuse me, I think that's, because I come across this similar philosophy about, switching the feeling, oh man, I'm nervous to I'm excited, because it's a lot of the same, chemical reactions in your head and all that kind of stuff. And I think one thing that you mentioned that really stood out was, sitting down and saying hey, I'm in this class, my whole grade depends on this exam. And then what it sounds like your perspective shift has been is what a cool opportunity that is. How awesome is it to be in this position, to be, it's like that, the quote, the Billie Jean quote, pressure is a privilege, that whole thing, to be here in this moment where I have an opportunity to, one, learn from all these great people, sick, cool, and then put it to the test and see, not necessarily. And I think that's so important that you mentioned that. And I think that's something that, is important to practice no matter the industry, no matter where you are in life, something I try to practice each and every single day, not seeing where you stack up against those around us, even though that's natural, right? We're looking around, but stack up against myself. And it looks like you had a thought going. So let it rip. What was popping in your head there?
So a quote that I really resonated with this year, partially because of law school. And then I played a role where I was able to joke around with friends and say things like, how does it feel to get all the A's? How does it feel to Cali in every class? And then, some people would just be like, oh, I didn't do that. I got X, Y, Z. And it was a very interesting time, because I think everyone is used to stacking their self-worth against a grade, being able to say I'm worth X because I have all A's or I have all B's. And one thing for me was, and I could not tell you who said the quote, but the quote is, comparison is the thief of joy. And it really resonated with me, because I realized, yes, I'm making a joke trying to have some camaraderie, but at the same time, I'm also self-deprecating by saying how's it feel for you to be the best, you know, and they would be uncomfortable too, because it's like, well, I'm not the best, you might be better. No one knows. And it's just everyone in their brain is comparing themselves. And you kind of, at least for me, I didn't realize I was doing it until I took a step back and was like, oh my God, I'm self-deprecating again. I'm not really being, my most authentic self. So then I had to kind of take a step back and go, well, why do I care? Why am I comparing myself to a grade or to other people's grades, when at the end of the day, it just matters about being the best attorney. And one of the big things, I think, I believe it was an associate told me while I was in law school, but he told me that all that matters is the bar exam. Mm-hmm. You know, 1L is very important. The rest of your law school is important. But if you don't pass the bar, no job cares. If you want to be an attorney, you got to pass the bar. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of made me realize, well, that's what I'm working towards. I'm not working towards an A in civil procedure. I'm working towards a bar exam, passing it, and being a lawyer. And so I think that kind of, that quote of just comparisons to thief of joy helped me kind of get back in my own game.
Now, kind of looking forward a little bit here, with so much weight being held on the bar, that's a good weightlifting pun there.
Love that.
Thanks. So with so much weight being put on the bar and stuff, how do you think, kind of looking into the future, you can approach that exam in a healthy and productive way to where it's like, all right, this is really all that matters, but still do it in a way where you're going to execute well. And like you're saying, still take this mentality in there. How do you kind of see that, this mentality playing out for when you do sit down, you know, in a year or two, couple of years for the bar?
I think it's a wonderful question, because I think it poses, you know, balancing prep work versus not trying to think too far ahead. You know, at least personally, I get caught up in, you know, forecasting or planning, you know, oh, what do I want to take 3L year? They haven't even released the spring classes yet. So why am I thinking about my 3L? So I try to, but the bar, as you said, bar exam, it's looming. It's something that it's the obstacle in the way. And I know our former baseball coach, Rudy Garbalosa, you know, he loved this quote. Again, I can't think of the author of the quote, but, you know, the obstacle is the way.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Holiday, I'm 99% sure. He has a book titled that. So,
okay, because I was going to say, big Ryan Holiday fan. We could dive into existentialism and personal philosophy later. Sure. But the idea of just, you have to get through it. You know, it's, everyone has to do it. And I think that's a big thing that I also learned in 1L. Is everyone's going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so when prepping for the bar, because I've asked, you know, some of the partners here and even the associates, like, what did they do? What programs? A lot of them, you know, would just say, use Barbary or see if your school offers a program. But it is an inevitable. It is the obstacle. It's going to be there. You can't avoid it. So you got to go through it. And I think it's one of those where in prepping for it and planning ahead, you can't stress too much on it, because as of right now, it's intangible. It doesn't mm-hmm. exist. Mm-hmm. So why would you cause stress on something that it doesn't affect you? At least doesn't affect me for two more years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a really big thing there, of not worrying about things that aren't even here yet, you know, cause mm-hmm. you don't get, in talking about being present in the moment, this, you know, July 12th, 2023, you know, we don't get this day back. And so we can spend the same amount of time worrying and then get to that point and realize, okay, yeah, those worries back then 2 years ago were right, or they weren't. Regardless, it doesn't impact that mm-hmm. that time, right? We can't tell. And so there's no sense in spending that time and energy, you know, doing that, which is, you know, really, really interesting point. And so much of, correct me if I'm wrong here, I'd imagine so much of law school takes a lot of time, effort, and energy, and yes. and all these things. So how do you go about balancing, making sure you're taking care of your business and then still taking care of yourself, being Hojo, doing your thing, you know, and being a person? Because I think that's such a big piece of success, is allowing yourself to just be. And so what does that look like for you?
So I think you could break this question up, because there's multiple, you know, nuggets of just gold in there. And I think first off, I have to say that I probably do not do a good job of balance. But I also would say that most law students are in that boat of trying to find that balance. I knew friends, I won't use names because personal reasons, but I had friends who they literally had blocked times in their schedule. And I saw them in the library and they would have a scheduled cry. They would cry at certain times. They would literally stop on a dime and go back to work as if nothing happened. And it was some of the scariest things I've ever seen. And it just kind of showed that everyone's struggling with the balance. It's very overwhelming. You got, you know, some nights, yeah, one night you may only have 20 pages of reading, and then somehow the next night you have 120 pages of reading, and you're like, how does this happen?
Right.
And I think a lot of it comes down to the trial by fire, trial and error of 1 week you have a routine and you think it's the best, and then the next week you find something that you can make it better in, and then the next week make it even better. And sometimes it's not always progress. Some weeks you struggle. So I had weeks where I won't say a full week where I didn't do a reading. I was not that kind of student, but I did have multiple days in a row where I did not open a textbook. I was burnt. My brain could not function anymore. I was watching review videos on the case summaries just to be able to get into class in case I was called. And there's just a lot of the trial and error and having to balance it's what works for the individual. You know, for this person, they knew that they were so wound up that they had to have a release, and it worked for them. They did very well this semester, and that's what their process was like. I was not that way, but at the same time, I would stay up till 1 a.m., 3 a.m. some nights studying, doing readings before going to bed, and then wake up the next day for class. So, you know, I think it's a trial and error thing that works well depending upon the person. But the second half to your question, and now that I've been ranting, I'm starting to forget it, but talking about, you know,
you kind of do to enjoy things,
yes,
looking outside of law school to really like take care of yourself, give yourself that time to recharge, and then get back to the grindstone, as they say.
So every week, and I can't speak for every law school, but I believe every law school has a similar kind of social event where once a week the law school students go out. And so for us, it's Thursday evenings. We call it bar review. I'm not in the main group messaging. You know, it's somebody just tells me, hey, we're all going to go to this pub tonight. You should be there. I go, a bunch of law students are there. So it allows having, you know, simple things like that, being able to go out, you know, being able to separate yourself from, you know, the grind of the law school, but also kind of the clubs and social groups that are, you know, within, whether it's, I know undergrad, you have your, you know, frats, sororities and stuff, but there are also societies and clubs in law school that, you know, for someone like me who first generation, I knew no one at Penn State, being a part of Phi Delta Phi, PDP, it's a legal honor society, being able to do that. I met a few great people that it just worked out well, that meet one guy, he's really cool, and he's like, oh, I like Sesame School, I'm going to hang out with him with so-and-so. And then next thing you know, I'm hanging out with three or four people, and it just kind of works out that way. So I think it's definitely partially based on how other people do it in law school, but I'm the one else. So I'm kind of basing how I do things off how other people do, but I think everyone is kind of there for each other in, you're not alone. We can take some time away from the library. We can go to a bar, we can go to a restaurant, have a drink, decompress. And when asking about friends for advice, like what advice would you give a 1L, or what would you tell yourself back then? A lot of it is to stress less. Don't make it worse than it is. Mm-hmm. Go out. I actually had someone literally today, when I asked them, they said to go out more, which sounds counterintuitive. But for her, she said, I can count on a single hand how many times I went out. And that just, she did very well in law school. So, I mean, no slam to what she dedicated her time to. But, you know, she's looking back like, well, you know, maybe I could have had a little bit more fun. Maybe I could have, like, you know, stressed less. And I think the law school, and not just Penn State, but people at UK, and we have a clerk also at Syracuse, the school environments allow the students to have that kind of freedom outside of the classroom to say, okay, we can all hang out and not talk about the law. That's another big thing, is that a lot of times at the bar review, maybe the first few weeks, because, you know, all the 1Ls, myself included, are just asking 101 questions about law school. But by September, they don't want to talk about, no one wants to talk about the law anymore. Everyone is sick of the law by that point. So at that point, you're kind of forced to socialize, communicate with everything else you have, and that it harbors just a friendly environment.
That's really awesome there. And what what I think is so cool looking kind of across industries is what we can learn from two fields that are completely different. And looking back at your time playing baseball, where you mentioned too, you know, before we kind of got going here, was, you know, law school is what your is your new baseball, essentially. And so with that kind of in mind, how has that approach, what commonalities have you seen with your approach to baseball in terms of the scheduling, the all-encompassing nature of it, and how is that, where has that kind of transitioned or translated into what law school has kind of looked like for you?
Well, I would say, you know, despite what my stats may show or what my friends may believe, you know, when I was 6 years old, between 6 and 8 was around the time that I decided, you know what, I'm going to be a professional baseball player. You know, I see a kid, there was a we had Austin Kearns. He played at the same little league park, and he had a banner that was like, you know, Austin Kearns played on this team at this ballpark, and he was, I believe, with the Reds or the Yankees at the time. And I was like, oh, if he can do it, I can do it. I'm going to do that. I'm going to be a professional baseball player. And so even when I was in law or in high school and talking to friends about, oh, I might go to school for business, or I might want to, you know, study economics or stuff like that, at the end of the day, it was still baseball. And I'll never forget senior year. I had not gotten picked up yet. I think it was after my showcase where I got my offer from Lynn, but still had not heard from Lynn at the time. And a girl in my class had asked me, basically, why are you doing this? Like, why put yourself through this? Why go play? You could go somewhere. You could go to UK. Like, you could apply, get accepted already. You have nowhere to go. It's December. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there kind of like, you just don't get it. Like, you don't understand what baseball means to, like, at that point, it wasn't even just like, oh, I'm going to go be a pro baseball player, screw everyone else. It was, I love baseball. Baseball was the degree. You know, business was the side hustle. I was there to play baseball. And so when you spend every day, especially at Lynn, South Florida, just, you know, you're at the field from noon to 5. It's 100 degrees. You're sweating through 3 shirts in the same practice. You know, and you're sitting there kind of thinking, like, you know, why am I doing this? But then, you know, you get a hit, you catch a ball, you just, the little things of the game bring you back to why you go through the hardships. And I try to keep the same kind of perspective with law school. And that's a big thing, that taking all the punches, taking all the hardships and saying, I still want to do this. You know, similar to that 8-year-old that was like, I want to be a professional baseball player. I don't care who stands in my way. After getting my grades back, and what I will recommend, no one should ever Google their law school GPA and then follow it with Reddit. Everyone is a liar. It is awful what they try to convince people to do if you have like a mediocre, even not a mediocre, like a slightly above average GPA, but they just will rip you because they're sad that they're not, that's not them, because they never went and did it. You did. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where taking, you got to roll with the punches, but it's also like reminding yourself, oh, I'm going to do this and I don't care who stands in my way. I know an attorney who, he failed the bar the first time, you know, and he's a brilliant dude. And he's like, it only motivated me to go take it again and study harder. Not because I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't pass the bar, but it's like, damn it, I'm going to be a lawyer and I'm going to see it through. And I think that's a big thing that I've tried to take with my studies and my experience at Penn State.
Yeah, staying connected to, you know, why you're doing it. And do you think that you're sweating as much in law school as you did on the baseball field?
Yes, like
physically sweating.
Yes. So, and the reason why is that not only the first cold call, but in my case, I would have to say it was the first week I was in civil procedure, and it wasn't like a true cold call. Like, it was just like a question, like, oh, what did they say in this case? Like, what was the plaintiff saying? Seth, what do you think? I literally I believe it was, and I don't even remember what I said. Like, I was flipping through and he like looks at me, his name's Judd Matthews, another excellent guy, but just looks at me and he's like, okay, Chloe. And Chloe's like right next to me. He's like, Chloe, if you, do you know what they said? And like, she literally just like goes right. And I'm reading in the back of the book, like back of the case, like in the case notes. And she's just like, right here, plaintiff did X. And I'm just like, oh God, I ruined it. So I'm, you know, blissing, you know, I'm sweating a storm. And then of course, when I get cold called by Romero, instantly sweat. I've had to get a new deodorant, basically. Mm. No, I'm not sponsored, but Mando deodorant, you know, odor-free control. Right. Big plus, you know, for those in law school. When,
like, if you're listening, Mando deodorant, you know.
Yeah. You know, I would love a sponsorship, but, you know, right. None taken, because it's an excellent product, you know. Right. When you're sweating bullets during a cold call, no one can smell because you got Mando on.
Right. Right. Again, not an ad, but, you know, just a little shout out.
Not an ad. Just quality products, you know, that's all you can ask for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, pardon me, this is live TV. So, you know, sometimes you get a little tickle in the throat, but looking forward, I know you say you're working not to do this. So I hate to ask you this question. What does it look like for you? You know, what are you hoping to do? What do you want to be when you grow up?
So I would say I would love to be myself. I want to stay authentic, stay genuine, but I know I want to be an attorney. I can't say in terms of a specialty yet. I know, you know, there are general practitioners in the law. There are people who spend their entire lives studying a very small subsect and they become an expert in that field. I have not gotten to that point yet. I would say that I have enjoyed working in a litigation law firm so far. A big thing that I've noticed, but partially here, is that when you work in transactional law and you work in big law firms, you don't get that kind of one-on-one time or that FaceTime with a client. You know, you're just hammering away at papers, memos, work, you know, a lot of busy work. They're, you know, you're one of many. You are a small number getting paid very handsomely. But in litigation, you know, you're talking to the client all the time. You're talking to a judge. You gotta have very good oral argument skills. And I think it really has kind of affirmed to me, it's like, okay, this is something that I could enjoy doing. They don't give me full, you know, authority to do what an attorney can do, but I being able to see the work firsthand definitely kind of affirms to me, it's like, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. If somebody tries to screw over my client, I want to be able to get a motion for summary judgment granted and then say, look here, judgment as a matter of law. Mm. So that would be pretty cool.
Nice. I love how you started that answer, by the way. That was pretty awesome. You took me on a roller coaster there and I loved every bit of it. So
I appreciate it. I try.
As we're wrapping up, it is that time of the show where you're going to leave us with a little extra money. We're going to cash out. So give us your biggest, baddest tip for anything that you've taken away, anything that you've learned that you want to leave the listeners with today. What do you have for us?
I would say the single most important thing, and I know I've said it before, but it's being genuine and being authentic. And truth be told, I could not have learned this without the help of Jeff Morgan at Lynn University. His new book, The Unwelcome Stranger, just released last year. And he actually has a great analysis on The Invisible Man, which is an existential novel that does help with talking about, you know, being a genuine person in a subsect group or in a certain demographic where, you know, you are a number. How do you differentiate yourself? And to me, one of the things that I was able to work with Jeff Morgan on is realizing its authenticity and being a genuine person. And it goes a long way. And, you know, it may sound remedial, it may sound simple, but it's something that gets very lost. And I didn't realize that until talking to partners at this law firm and talking to friends trying to get jobs in other law firms. Because I was, my first 2 weeks, I was trying to act like a clerk. You know, I was trying to act all this, you know, be almost pompous. And one of the partners who I had done a couple of assignments for basically was kind of like, you know, hey, like, love that you're like super energized. Like, you know, you're great. You know, love the energy. But I didn't, you're not here because we need a clerk. Like, I mean, yes, there, I'm here to be a clerk, but it's like, I want Seth. I don't want clerk number X. I want Seth to talk to me like Seth does. Don't talk to me what you think you're supposed to say to me. Talk to me like a human being. Mm-hmm. And him and I have like a great back and forth now. And it's one of the things that also is reaffirmed talking to friends. One of my friends, Noah Eastman, he's one of the top people at Penn State Law. I hope he's not upset with me name dropping him like that. But he was telling me that with his interviews, the biggest thing that he saw is that in the interviews that he felt his most genuine, those are the interviews that went not only the best, but they got callbacks from. So the interviews, and that's how I felt with my interview here, that I felt very authentic, very genuine. I did not feel like, you know, I had to stick up my butt. Like, I felt just very myself. And I think it shows in the interview. And at the, you know, a lot of times when you get rejections, I have faced more rejection in 2023 alone than any other year in my life. I'm not joking. I've been rejected by more places, people, and things this year than any year combined. But I'm also probably my most positive because I know that the opportunities that did not work out probably weren't going to anyway. You know, because I at least can say it to some extent, I've remained genuine and authentic all year, that it's shown through my work and it's shown through things that the times that opportunities don't go my way, I'm not as bitter about it because I can sit there and say, oh, well, if I tried my best and it didn't work out, big whoop. And, you know, I tried, you know, I showed them who I was. If they didn't like that, big whoop, because later on, once I'm working there and I get comfortable, they wouldn't like that, you know, 6 weeks later. Whereas at least here, it was only a, you know, week to 2 week span of, you know, acting like a idiot and then realizing, oh, I need to be myself. Mm-hmm. I was hired because I'm Seth, not because I'm Clerk X.
Right. Wow. I mean, what more can we say? That was just a beyond outstanding way to end a beyond outstanding show. And I'd be remiss to not comment for those who are just listening in. Seth is wearing the most powerful power ties, red power ties, today on the show. And he brought his best, clearly not just dressing, but with his thoughts and his mind. So Seth, I can't thank you enough for coming on today.
I really appreciate the opportunity. You know, I'm a longtime listener, not a caller, but first time guest, very appreciative for the opportunity. And I would love to just wrap up with that, what you're doing, what this conversation facilitates on a bigger scale is the equivalent of someone talking to their friends about, you know, what did you do to get a job? How are you you and I spoke before this interview, but also, you know, we spoke about how we've talked to former teammates about what they've done, how they've grown, and fostering those kind of connections. And I think a big thing that you've done is have a medium for that conversation, because, you know, 2 years ago, I did not expect to be here. And I know our former colleagues, Billy and Vic Danza, probably are in similar boats, where when they were at Lynn, they did not exactly think that they're going to be where they are now, but they're grateful that they are. So it just, I think it goes to show not only was Lynn baseball a quality team, but you're doing the Lord's work. In a brief summary, you're just doing the Lord's work.
I appreciate that. I'll take that home with me. And Seth, you're the man. So thanks so much again.